Let's look at RHI. On Friday, Jonathan Bell finished giving evidence to the RHI inquiry. He was speaking during the second day of evidence to the public inquiry into it all. The newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, has been following events. Morning to you, Sam.
Morning, Stephen.
So, what happened then on day two?
It really largely followed the pattern in day one. We had lots of questions to Mr. Bell and we had lots of answers, but not a great deal more information in many cases as to what actually happened. He was very vague as to what had happened at many of the key points. He was often not categorically saying that the evidence which has come from his former special advisor or from civil servants or from other people was wrong, but saying that he just couldn't recollect what had happened. He was often imprecise about dates and details. He said he wasn't sure about certain things. He was often anecdotal about what had happened.
Although, Sam, we are, to be fair to him, we are going back a couple of years. Like, could you remember what happened a few years ago?
I struggle to recall what happened about 2 weeks ago. So I've got a lot of sympathy for him on that front. I think one of the difficulties which all of the witnesses to the inquiry are facing is not just that they're going back 2 or 3 years in some cases, or much longer if it's at the early stages of the scheme, but there's so little written evidence to back this up. So Mr. Bell wasn't really coming into the inquiry with lots of his own notes. He wasn't coming in with minutes. He wasn't coming in with details. He was saying that he assumed that the civil servants were doing that for him. We now know that in many cases they weren't. So really it was a case of his recollection of what happened. And the striking thing about his recollection, I suppose, is that on many of these occasions it was pretty scant. It was pretty sparse. Whereas with some of the civil servants, with some of the other people, there has been more of a recollection. It's not that they recollect everything. Everyone is saying at some point, I just don't know, and that's perfectly understandable. But it was striking, and I suppose one of the big questions which the inquiry is looking at, and one of the allegations which Mr. Bell's former special advisor has made, is that he was a minister who wasn't really across the detail. He wasn't involving himself in these big decisions, and he was leaving a lot of this to the civil service. And I think that's one of the things which, during Mr. Bell's evidence, he struggled to disprove by saying, well, here is the clear recollection which I have, or the evidence that I have, that I was really on top of what was going on here.
Let's talk about the secret recordings that Jonathan Bell did. He had a tape recorder up his coat or up his jacket when he was recording, when he was speaking to Dr. Andrew McCormick, who was the permanent secretary at the time, recording their meeting because he might not have been getting the accurate information otherwise, according to him. He was pressed by Sir Patrick Coughlan, Sam, on the reason for the concealed recording. And Sir Patrick Coughlan noted that Mr. Bell regarded Dr. McCormick as a man of integrity. Let's have a listen.
Let's just look at what Mr. Schofield is asking you about. You went to, I think, Netherley.
That's right.
To look at documents.
Yes.
And the convention, or the protocol, is you're not going to be allowed to remove those documents.
That's right.
So you go to look at the documents with a man whom you recognise is a man of integrity.
Yes.
Why not tell him that you want to record the meeting?
Because I felt that the purpose of the recording was for my personal use.
Oh, that's fine, but why not tell him you're doing it?
I had a real concern that if records were being expunged and changed and amended, would I be getting the accurate information?
Why not tell him that you are going to record the meeting?
Because I felt that I would get a more accurate discussion from him if he was... first of all, I'd been told previously that when discussing things with civil servants, every civil servant is aware that a record doesn't have to be kept in pen and paper. Secondly, I'd requested a meeting with him, and I just wanted to have a record for myself of my very real concerns.
Well,
there's no other answer for it than that.
You have told us already that you regarded him as a man of integrity. And all I'm trying to find out, I hope I will be able to, is why, given that assumption on your part, your acceptance of him, of his integrity, you found it necessary to carry out a concealed recording. Now, one possible inference is that you did not consider him to be a man of integrity.
answer to that is I do believe him to be a man of integrity. Uh-huh. But I also believe, and he did a contemporaneous accurate account, and also under the advice that understand that at that time that the permanent secretary had to act to his current minister, who may or may not want information released. All I wanted to do was to have a record, and it may be a conflict with integrity as you place it so well, and if so, then so be it.
Why not arrange for Netherley to provide a shorthand note taker who you can both see, and you can require him or her to make a note of whatever it is you think is important, such as identifying particular records, such as your observations about those records? Why go about it with a concealed recorded device?
Because I had a major concern that behaviour had been undertaken through the special advisors and everything else that I wanted to have a proof record of. And, I mean, what had happened was I'd asked for the meeting. I think we'd been told, oh, we'll get there at some stage. We'll get you documents at some stage. You want, they're hard to get. At one stage, I'd phoned up and said, look, nobody in the department knows where Andrew McCormick is. I'd then been asked to go to... I then went to the department before the close of play and was told he's somewhere now in Parliament buildings. Would you like to go and search for him? We don't know where he is and he won't answer his phone. And it was only when I said, look, I'm going to stay here. These are the documents I requested. This is what I want to see. I had serious concerns that the actual information that I was seeking and needing was being evaded.
When you went into the interview with Dr. McCormick, you knew that you were seeing him. You knew that you were going to be shown documents. He was a man of integrity. I still, I'm afraid, do not see why it was necessary to bring a concealed recording device.
Sam?
I think that is largely self-explanatory, but behind all of that is Dr. McCormick's evidence to the inquiry that he finds this profoundly disturbing, that he didn't realise that this was happening. This was not something which civil servants were used to having been done to them by former ministers. And the essential question there, I suppose, is that you would normally secretly record somebody, and obviously there are very good public interest reasons why sometimes people ought to be secretly recorded, but you generally do that where you don't trust somebody. Mr. Bell's evidence to the inquiry was very clear that he had a very high regard for Dr. McCormick. He believed that he was somebody who was a person of integrity, and yet he brought this secret recording device with him. The other issue, which we didn't get into there in the oral evidence, but which is in his written evidence, is that we now know that Mr. Bell has deleted the first 17 minutes of that recording. We know that he hasn't given the inquiry the original audio of that. He has given them a copy of that. And that is because he says that he was starting to record from before he was in the meeting. We know from Dr. McCormick's evidence that at the start of this meeting, there was discussion about Christian faith, about all sorts of aspects of life, which has been cut out of that. So I think there are a series of questions around what transpired there and what Mr. Bell's motives were which we didn't have at the time when we first learned about this.
We also know that Jonathan Bell recorded other people. He seemed to use this recording device quite often. So we know that he recorded Carla Lockhart, correct?
That's right.
I know that he recorded Peter Robinson. I know that he recorded other people as well on this device. So maybe he was gathering evidence, or maybe he recorded people at a whim. I don't know, but I know who he recorded, Sam.
Well, one of the questions for the inquiry here, which they were pressing him on, is really about how much of this information, when he gave his interview to you, where he was pretty categorical about a lot of the aspects of this. He certainly came across as somebody who knew what he was talking about, who was clear, who was backed up, he said, by senior civil servants. The central question, I think, out of this is how much of that did he actually know before he spoke to Dr. McCormick? So we have the transcript of what Dr. McCormick said to him. Some of what Dr. McCormick said to him, because he thought it was a candid private conversation, he says was slightly wrong. He was speaking too candidly. He was saying something that actually in reflection isn't quite right. But Mr. Bell took that as the absolutely unvarnished truth of what had happened. And just as I am now speaking quite carefully to you because I know that this is being broadcast, but if I was speaking to you privately, it might be more candid, but I might also be saying things that I'm not entirely 100% certain of. I think there is a question as to how much weight ought to be put on a secretly recorded conversation where potentially somebody is saying something that is more candid, that gives us more information, but also potentially they're just speaking more freely and they're not giving us something which is absolutely precise, where they've double-checked things. And Mr. Bell seems to have certainly taken the view that what he was hearing there was the absolute truth.
Yeah, but Sam, to be fair to him, you can look at that another way, and you can say that, look, you know, why would someone say something if it wasn't true? And therefore, if you are recording it, then you have what they have said. Like, why would anyone ever say anything that wasn't true?
Well, I think there's certainly no excuse for anybody saying something which isn't true. I suppose there is a weight which somebody gives to something when they know that it's on the record. You will be absolutely sure that something is accurate. You might say something because you believe it's right, but you've got a 95% belief it's right, but you're not absolutely certain because you're saying it candidly, privately. It's off the record. It's not something that's going to be broadcast or published. But you would be fair to those people in a different way if you were thinking that this was going on the record.
Who is up this week in front of the inquiry?
We've got two very significant witnesses. We've got Timothy Kearns tomorrow, who was Mr. Bell's former special advisor. We know from his evidence that he says that he did try to delay cost controls, and therefore he does back up one of Mr. Bell's central allegations. The question then is why he did that, and he says it was other people in the DUP, and he says it was Andrew Crawford, Arlene Foster's special advisor, who did that. Dr. Crawford denies that, but he will be back up at the inquiry later this week. So two very significant witnesses.
Okay. Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed. If you want to follow all of the information from the RHI Inquiry, rhiinquiry.org or the BBC News NI website.